and I'm a grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship Al-Anon. My sister's here from St. Martinville, and I'm so delighted she's here. Welcome, Doreen. I love you. She's the only member of our family who practices the principles and this 12-step program. So I am especially happy that she's here. Until she got into the fellowship, I had many, many, many sisters, and those were all of you. But now I have one who is blood kin. If I make it, and I know I will, that's one thing I'm sure of, until October, I will be in Al-Anon 19 years. So I'm just delighted. And thanks to all of you, I'm enriched as I continue to come back over and over and over again. And I am a party animal. And I have to tell you, first of all, Ruth is so special to me. I heard this morning at a meeting that behind every special or successful man, there is a woman, you know, a special woman. Well, I'm here to tell you that behind every special program member, there's a special sponsor, and that is Ruth. Ruth has just been fantastic. She's been there when I've been the lowest or the highest, and for that I'm truly, truly grateful. I'm also grateful for the committee for asking me. Now, I'll tell you about the phone call I made Tuesday morning. I called Ruth and I said, "Ruth, I cannot do this talk. You're going to have to do it. You have to suit up, show up, and do this talk." She says, "Why?" And this I'll tell you a little later at the end of the program. But Ruth and I discussed it and prayed. And I said, "Pray with Cleet and let me know." So we prayed together and talked together and all that. So anyway, I'm here. And when we sat at the table, we were doing the little things on the table. And I didn't know any answers. So Ruth says, Faye, "You cannot be the speaker today." I said, "Fine, y'all draw straws to see who will be." I was born in the back of a bar. I'm the second of nine children, and that is the honest truth, that my parents had a grocery store and a bar. And we lived behind the bar. And my earliest memory was getting up, waking up, and walking into the bar barefoot, a little nightie on, and some nice Cajun guy would pick me up, and I'd walk up and down the bar and dance. And so I really am a party animal. I've been one since birth. And I loved it. And they would give me nickels, and I'd dance for them. And it was just wonderful. It was just wonderful. I loved my life. And I guess the next memory was my daddy going off to war. But anyway, we lived that way, and that's the way you lived in South Louisiana. And I don't remember drinking being a real problem, except that as time went on, alcoholism killed many of my family members. My mother was the first victim, and she died of Al-Anonism, and she was, I believe, in a brownout and had an accident one morning, and my father wouldn't go to mass with her, so she went and had an automobile accident and so forth. But anyway, she was the first victim. My older brother died, and she was 30, by the way, my mother was. My older brother died at 30 as well, wrapped around a tree, and as a result of alcoholism. And my younger brother, at 40, died on the streets of San Francisco in a drug raid, I believe it was. We have been victim in our family at a very young age to alcoholism. Our father died young as well, but he was 57, so that at the time he died, that was, you know, pretty old, but now it's really young. we have been victim. And then there are several family members who do qualify, but that's another story. When our mother died, we were sent to an orphanage right here in Baton Rouge. And I just hated it, but it's the best thing that ever happened to me. I got the most wonderful education there. It was really a gift and a blessing. And, life went on, and I continued to dance on tables. I mean, I just had a wonderful time. I'd go home on weekends. I remember one Christmas, we wouldn't do any dancing or any of that stuff during Advent at the time. So we would go to midnight mass, and after midnight mass, we'd go have a gumbo somewhere, and we'd dance and, you know, just have a wonderful time. And I had no curfews, because my father was drunk, and, you know, I had no curfews. What else can I say? So as a teenager, I would get to go to, you know, the bars, and all the girls would have to be home by a certain time. Not they. I could just stay in the bar, and I can remember the boys were lined up to dance with me because I guess I was the only girl there, and I loved it. It was wonderful. And I don't even know what age I was, because anybody could get a drink. I mean, you didn't even have to be tall enough to see over the bar. And so, I mean, I always had this one big drink. I really wouldn't drink very much of it because I love to dance, and so, and that's what I did. Oh, it was fun. It was a life. And then I'd have to go back to the orphanage, and I hated that, but still, that was a good thing. So life marched on, and finished high school, and I just knew that I would get sent to college because people in the JCs told me I would. People in the Lions Club told me I would. See, they'd pick up the orphans and take us to, Christmas parties. They'd have all this stuff for us. And, you're such a cute little girl. I'm going to see, where are you going to go to college? I said, oh, I don't know, but I know I'm going. And they would say, yes, you are. I'm going to see to it that you were. And I graduated, and I looked around, and none of those people were there. I mean, I knew I was going, but at this point, I knew that, you know, they had things like tuition and room and board, but it didn't matter. I mean, I was going to go. My dad refused to pay for my tuition and pay for my stuff, so I thought, this is interesting. How am I going to do it? But I did it. I mean, program was instilled in me even at that time, because I did have a higher power, and I guess the higher power is what directed me. And I did. I figured out a way. I worked. I borrowed money. I did all those things, and I did. I got a college degree. In my senior year, it was the summer before, my roommate was going to Grand Isle for 4th of July. See, when we had a break, we didn't have a spring break. We had, you know, it was over 4th of July. We would go to Grand Isle. Now, today they go to Cancun and go on cruises and all that stuff. We went to Grand Isle. And I loved it. And we went with the football team. For some reason, my father would let me go out and stay out till the wee hours of the morning, but I called him. Why in the world did I call him? But I did, and I said, Dad, I want to go to Grand Isle with Mary. No, you can't go. And I thought, well, I signed out and went anyway. Well, oh, no, I know what I did. I signed out to say I was going to Lockport with Mary to visit her and her family. Well, the football team picked us up on the way. and took us to Grand Isle. And we were staying at, somebody had a big old house and there were servant quarters behind it. Now I was still a little, and Mary was too, we were little Catholic educated school girls, and we were horrified to think that we were going to stay with the football team. And we just knew we'd find somebody to stay with when we got there. Well, we got there and we couldn't find anybody to stay with. So they told the football, and we really weren't dating any of those guys. They were really just friends. So we stayed in the servants' quarters and the football team stayed in the main house. And I did not sleep a wink. I just looked around and looked around all night long. I said, I know the big house is going to burn down and the fire is going to trail all the way to the guest house and we're going to all burn down. And people are going to say, Faye and Mary were with the football team. And they're not going to know that we weren't in the house with the football team. They were going to think that we were, you know, all shacked up. And I said, oh, my God, and my daddy's going to find out, and he's going to kill me. Now, I'm going to already be dead, right? But my dad's going to find out. So anyway, that's the way I thought. But the reason I'm telling you about this incident is that we were walking on the beach the next morning, and I saw this guy sleeping on a log. And I thought, where did he come from? And my two cousins were there. And this guy sleeping on the log was with my two cousins. I said, where'd y'all find him? Well, it turns out I went over there and they said, oh, well, that's Kirby. He's from St. Marville. I said, he's kind of cute. So I went and I woke him up. And sure enough, he followed us along the island. He bought all the hot dogs, all the beer. The clincher was, we went to T-Man's, and this must have been about 10 o'clock in the morning, and the band was playing, of course, and we danced, and we danced, and we danced. Well, y'all, I was hooked. I was hooked. He made a date with me to meet him at sunset down the island, and I thought, he must think I'm one of those girls. I mean, just because I was spending the weekend with the football team, I mean, why would he think that? So I made up my mind. I said, let me tell you one thing. I'm talking to myself. I am not that kind of girl, and I'm going to stand him up. So I made a decision, and I went ahead, and we were having a good time. And by that time, Mary and I found a place to stay so I'd get to sleep that night. So the next morning, I found out something that absolutely incensed me. Kirby and my two cousins left the island at 5 p.m. That sucker stood me up. So that was the basis of our meeting, and we did date and marry. And if we make it until September the 6th, we will be married 40 years. So we got married, and it's been, I can't say it was good. There have been some good times, and there have been some rough times, and there have been some rougher times. But all in all, I guess it's been okay. The most recent times have been good. We got married. We had $6 between us. Now, I thought he was rich because he was buying all the hot dogs and the beer for everybody. Well, it turns out my two cousins, I mean, you know, we're super manipulators, obviously. They had him. He'd just gotten his paycheck when they went to Grand Isle, and so they had him buy everything, and they were going to split the tab when they got home. So not only was he not rich, but he was broke, because my cousins never paid him back. So we would go out and share a Coke, etc. But anyway, we had zero money, and we had school loans to pay back. But the morning he got married, now this is, you might think we lived in primitive land, but let me tell you what happens in a small town. The postmaster, we got married at 10 o'clock in the morning. The postmaster opened up the post office because Kirby was waiting on his check, you know, his month. I hadn't gotten mine. So he said to Kirby, he says, "I hear you getting married this morning." He said, "Yes, sir." And he said, I really need my paycheck." We'd made a pact. If we got paid, we'd go to New Orleans to spend the night for our honeymoon. If not, we were coming right to Baton Rouge to our apartment. So the postmaster dumped all the mail in the middle of the floor. He took Kirby in the back of the post office. They found the check. He goes to the bank. He bangs on the door. In those days, banks opened on Saturday morning. They, "Kirby, you getting married this night?" "Yeah, and I need this check cash." So they cashed his check. So he comes, and he's what? I see him coming down the aisle, and he looks at me, and he says, So that was it. We were thrilled. We had a paycheck. We went to New Orleans. So that thus our life began, and we had a son and a daughter, and eventually got the big house and got the two cars, and I was never happy. I just thought, well, when this happens, I'm going to be happy. When that happens, I'm going to be happy. And the world, you know, time marched on, and my younger brother, the one I told you died in San Francisco, I just really loved him so much. He co-parented with me, with the younger sisters. You know, we had nothing, obviously. And the only money I ever had was what I made working in the kitchen and stuff, and that was a dollar a week. So, I mean, that didn't go very far in, you know, getting little prom dresses and special stuff for myself and the children. So my brother got a real job, and he would, you know, provide not only monetary things but support. And, oh, he was wonderful. He was a special, special guy. And so anyway, he got involved in alcohol. My older brother did too, but you know, I didn't like him very much. So, I mean, it isn't that I was glad that he died. I mean, I was sad, but you know, I just didn't like him very much. But the younger one, when he got into the disease, it was like, he can't do this. He can't do this to me. If he loved me, he wouldn't drink. If he loved me, he wouldn't. But he was changed. So anyway, he went down real fast and moved, took geographical cures. And that was my first experience with really feeling the effects of alcoholism. Because my father was, but we were taken care of. And then I was kind of glad, you know, not to be around my father, but my brother. And so he would call me with his last dime, and Kirby was so upset because I was so upset. And of course, I couldn't function if my brother was in jail. So he'd go off and bail him out of jail, and I would stay and paste the smile on, and I would host the parties we were obligated to host. And I would, one time, that morning, I was like a zombie. I hadn't slept for days because I was just worried about him. Because when my brother called, he said, "Faye, they took my shoes, my feet are cold." So I would kick the blankets off of me. And I just think about him all the time. I mean, talk about obsessed. I was absolutely obsessed. Kirby would take care of the children, feed them, send them off to school, and I was like a zombie. So we were hosting an announcement party or something for a cousin. So he went off, and he says, I can't tolerate this. So he went and bailed him out of jail, and then we took him to another institution, and you know, went on and on. Well, everything that I did, all the money I would send, I would, you know, all the sleepless nights, wringing my hands, and he died anyway. He died anyway. So when our daughter got to be of age, our two children were hilarious. We had one, our son, who was just, I mean, he was just into everything. If there was a fight at school, you'd hear about it. I knew it was my son. I mean, that was it. He was just always into everything. Our daughter was the perfect child, you know, straight A's, the whole thing. So we got a phone call. One of your children has a problem with alcohol. She's an alcoholic. And that's when CDU opened and brand new and everybody was going in, it seems like. So we couldn't believe it, but we did. We went and, you know, did the evaluation, and she was, you know, determined that she was alcoholic. So the whole family signed up for this program, this have a 3-month program at the time. And Kirby and I went home, and he said, "Faye, just think, she won't be able to toast champagne at her wedding." And I thought, oh, but then maybe by that time she'll be okay enough to have champagne at her wedding. Or maybe we can get something that looks like champagne. At this time, we were running with a pretty fast crowd, because remember, I'm the party animal, and I love to be at those places where we dance and just have a wonderful time. And so we went with a pretty fast crowd, and they told us, or we were asked to sign a commitment that we wouldn't drink for 3 months. And I thought, what are we going to do at these parties? And we have sit-down dinners, and they have wonderful wine, and I can't be rude and impolite. So anyway, we signed it, and I would get vodka with lime to pretend that, you know, I'm drinking a drink just like everybody else. And then I would turn my wine glass over, but I would say, I'd rather just drink this stuff now. You know, I'm off of wine. I want this. So, I mean, I would really lie about it. But then I met you, and my whole life changed. My whole life changed because I had really been through the bottom of the barrel with my brother. I needed you so badly then that when I met you and walked into the rooms of Al-Anon, I knew I belonged, because those were the tools that I needed. That I could have serenity if the alcoholic is drinking or not. It's like I could have had a life. I could have raised my children. I could have been a wife. I could have been a mother. I could have functioned while my brother was whirling around in California. It wasn't real easy, though. Although, Leah said, okay, I'll do this. She did relapse and all, and ended up going for extended treatment. And I thought my heart would just break when they clean them up. You take them over there, and she was, you know, beautifully coiffed and looked wonderful. And so they took her in there, scrubbed her up, and she comes out in the pajamas and the, you know, the hair, and said, "Mom, please don't leave me here." And I thought, oh my God, how can you do it? Well, we did it. And there were two incidences. The first time that when we went through the family program, we got all the good tools and good information. So the time between the first treatment and the relapse was a time of really of enrichment for me, you know, where I really got all the clues that I could have a life. But I hadn't been tested. And so it was obvious that there had been a relapse, not because of misbehavior, but because of super great behavior. You know, when they're too nice and too sweet and doing too much of the right thing. But the real clue was the AA kids went away, and the other playmates, the former playmates, came. So I did what every parent, what a standing parent would do. I picked up the phone and called her sponsor. And I said, hey, I said, you've got to do something. The clues are here. This kid's drinking again. And I got on this obsessive thing. I would run down there and look at what page the 24-hour book was on. So, I mean, I just kept tabs, and I did what any, Alan, when they were reading the steps and the traditions of the past, now I know why I'm so sick and why it takes so much, because that's what I thought my lot in life was, to make sure that she adheres to this program. So what ended up the miracle that occurred when she relapsed was that we knew she would have to leave home. And she was 16 years old. And I had a gift directly from God. I had a gift directly from God that she would be okay. And that night, she just came and crawled between us like she did when she was a little bitty girl. And we all cried together. She and Kirby and I, we just sobbed in knowing that God would take care of her. And if she chose the alcohol and that. And another miracle happened that she says, please give me another chance, let me go to treatment. And so, but anyway, when we'd lock in the door, when they taken her behind the locked door, she said, Mom and Dad, please don't leave me here. And so here it is again, boing. But I knew God was gonna take care of her. And God, I suppose, has. And that day I realized that I had a life to live and I had to love her enough to let her live her life. So we went home, and at that time I was doing circuits of work all over, you know, and I had a plane ticket to fly out that morning to go to do a seminar out of town. And I thought, if she were in the hospital, if she were dying, I would cancel this. And I thought, well, you know, because I couldn't cancel my program. What would the National Bankers Association do without me to give them their program? Well, I mean, get a grip. Today I can look at that and say, get a grip. So I did do one thing. God said, okay, Faye, cancel this flight. So I did it, got on the phone. Get home. We get home and I thought, oh, Kirby and I are going to sit and have this heart-to-heart talk. And we're going to, you know, do a be-with. By the time I got undressed, got comfortable, went back to the living room, he is reared back in his easy chair, snoring. And I said, am I going to sit here and watch him snore? So I got on the phone, I said, when's the next plane out? And I left and I went. And y'all, God sent angels to me on the limousine, in the limousine. I had this man, and I wasn't going to talk to anybody. Obviously, I didn't feel like chatting. This man started talking about his child who was, they just found out about, you know, the alcoholism. And I mean, and the man just talked. I didn't have to say a word. That was an angel sent to me. I was comforted from the time I got off the plane all the way to the hotel. When I got to the hotel, I had a message that should I choose to join the conference, I was welcome to. However, they realized my, you know, it was late, all that stuff. In other words, I was excused. Go to my room. Here's this gorgeous bouquet of flowers. And room service had been ordered. All I needed to do was say when. So I was pampered, and it was just wonderful. So I got up in the morning, did my little ditty, and you know, got back on the plane and came back. So God comforted me and, you know, took care of me when, you know, when I wasn't able to do it for myself. So this is the steps that I took. My first round of steps between my child's relapses were, I didn't take steps. I took the elevator. I just went zoom. But we go from one, you know, and walk the steps, walk the walk. But I just went zoom to 12. I mean, I was a motor mouth to everybody I knew. This is a wonderful program. This is great. Da, 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 da. So 12 was my first step. My next favorite step that I did was 9, making amends, because 9 I love too, because I thought, wow, this is going to get it all out. So I took my little book and I looked at it, read 9, ran to Leah's room, and she was getting ready to take a shower. And I said, oh, darling, and I made my amends to her. And I said, so? And she looked up at me and she said, you mind passing the shampoo to me? And I thought, I was waiting for her to give me amends back. I mean, isn't that why you did amends? So you could get amends back? I mean, in polite society, you know, you give it out and you, well, that didn't happen. So what I decided was, after the second time, I really, for the first time, got real, and I walked in to the meetings, and just as I'm very, very humbled that you asked me to be here and speak today, I was a little bit humbled at that time to, you know, to start at the first step and go from there. And the first step for me is to just surrender and say, hey, God, I can't do this. I need your help. See, I was always into self-will, and I thought I had done steps, but, like, you know, at different times in my life, I would just say, hey, God, I can do this. And I tended to manipulate with my husband and my children, and it really has been difficult for me to let go. One of the things that's still occasionally difficult for me to let go is about what route to take when we're going somewhere. Now, the disadvantage is I was born in Baton Rouge. So when you get to Essen and Jefferson Highway, and you ride with somebody who takes a left to go to Hammond Air Shopping Center, which is right here, I have a little bit of a problem with that. But we've always gotten to Hammond Air Shopping Center. But it was a long, long time before I could just zip it up and ask God, stand guard over my mouth. We've got the extra 15 minutes. We can go that way and back around to right here. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar, that corner intersection I'm telling you about is, as a crow flies, about a block away. So we would go all the way around. So anyway, I need help. I need a lot of help. But to let go, and say, God, just surrender and say, hey, God, I can't do this, has been a difficult thing for me, and I've done it with the alcoholics in my life. I've done it with a lot of problems that I have, but it's kind of like some of the little things kind of keep poking at me. Then, coming to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, that's when I really say, okay, God, I've already said I can't, and then I get into the belief system that you can. And as you know, I've told you, I didn't trust anybody. So it gives me a lot of pain when I think about my brother and letting him go, and knowing that if I don't do something, he's going to die. Well, the thing I didn't know is that I could detach, and I could let go, and I could let God. I could detach from him which I didn't know how to do, but you taught me that I can detach, like detaching from my child, and I can attach her to her higher power, my higher power, and she is safe. And God can do for her what I could never dream of doing. Never, ever, ever dream of doing. So I was able to detach from her with love, and still today I have to detach from her with love. Because the higher power, my higher power, her higher power, yields unconditional love, absolute unconditional love. And in the third step, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. That is total surrender. That is absolute total surrender. And prior to recovery in our family, many relationships, probably most of them, were triangulated. Very triangulated. I would say to our son, he thinks he knows how to do everything, talking about my husband. But you're wonderful. You can do wonderful things, because my husband would in turn say to him, you just can't do anything. So, I mean, I would take up for Joey. Then Kirby would, you know, bring out all his shortcomings, and then I would try to build him up. Then with Leah, I would befriend Leah. If we want a trip, I would say, God, look at the route he took. Isn't that ridiculous? So, I mean, you know, it was triangulated. It was just bad news. It was unhealthy. I mean, I would have a best friend. I would be best friends with the children, sort of against him, and then he likewise against me. And, I mean, here we are. We are married to each other. And so, I mean, it was kind of sicky. After recovery, I had a real, real traumatic experience. This perfect child got into recovery and worked a really good program, and she made a decision she was going to move to Shreveport. This was during college, to live with this guy. And I thought, oh my God, why didn't she lie to me? Why didn't she tell me she was going to just move to Shreveport? That would have been fine. Why did she tell me it's to move in with this guy? My God. And of course, my decision is very simple. Just cut her off. Go ahead and move in with the guy, but no more tuition, no more, car gas, all that stuff. And about that time, the Thursday noon meeting was starting, and it was very, very small. And it was like just a support. I mean, there were five of us. And we had lots of meetings on control. We had lots of meetings on detachment. So what I came up with through the help of you, especially those five, was I trying to control? And I absolutely was. So I turned that whole thing over to God. And one thing a wonderful gal told me, and she's in the back of the room today, was, Faye, acceptance does not mean approval. Acceptance does not mean approval. And I said, thank you, God. Thank you, Lord. And she went to Shreveport with my blessing. And, you know, that was wonderful. It was, again, I could really detach from the fact that she was doing that. And I guess the other part of that was, do you want to lose your daughter? I think that was the bigger one. So we kept a good relationship through this. I never did like the situation, but that was really, you know, her business. But I can imagine me doing that. I mean, coming from, you know, scared of your daddy when he's too drunk to even know what you're doing, let alone have an opinion about it. And your daughter does the same thing, but she's honest. She comes out and says it. I mean, I wasn't used to people like that. Came to step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. That's, for me, is the healing process. When I harbor resentments, I'm doing instant replays of all this wrong that's going on. It's like, you know how they do the football? When you're watching it on TV, they'll replay the deal. And I replay these things that hurt. I replay them and replay them. So to get rid of those, I have to process them. And for me, the fourth step is my processing. When I can't do a tenth step, just a bing bang, let's get it over with, make the amends, I have to go through the process. And I remember one day, Kirby and I were headed to Club 12 to a meeting, and I mean, he was on a rampage. He was all upset about I don't know what, and he just kept bitching. And I thought, if we don't get there fast, I'm just going to blow up. So we got there, I opened the door, and I said, and then I did it. It just took me about 10 seconds, and I just blasted at him, and I slammed the door, and I went in Club 12, and I'm just prim and proper, and I plopped down, and it was like, now I've got one. This is something that I'm entitled to. So I sat down, and the topic that day was on resentments, as a matter of fact. And I said, let me tell y'all one thing. I was only 5% wrong. I mean, I was blasted 95% of bad behavior, and all I did was this little itsy bitsy bitsy. And somebody looked at me. I was sitting on that old beat-up couch, and they looked at me, the whole group. I expected them to say, yay, Faye, you didn't do much. That was fine. You did good. And they said, Faye, if you are 5% wrong, it's like being pregnant. You are pregnant. So you are wrong. I didn't like that. I did not like that. So I had a choice. They said, you have a choice. You can be right or you can be miserable. And I didn't like that either. So I found that, yeah, I had to do the steps on that. And it was more my anger, that little 5 second or 10 second burst of anger. There's a lot more to it than what surfaced, obviously. So I just got into, yeah, I got to do the steps. Now, a lot of people talk about my fourth step like it's one, like it's, what do you have one of in life? I don't know. One body, one mind, one. Well, for me, I have to have more than one. When the maintenance steps don't work for me, I have to dig deeper and I have to do another fourth step. So I did the one, initially, and did it real fast because I had to get to the ninth step. So the first one I did real fast. And I did a thorough inventory. And then when these isolated things have come up, my format for a fourth step is very similar to the AA. It's in columns, and it's simple, and it works for me. And people I sponsor use it, and it seems to work for them. And my first column has to do it says what happened. And maybe there are five things that happened. But, okay, like in that case, I had an outburst at Kirby. The second thing, what are my feelings? Well, I was feeling angry. I was feeling, I can't tell you all the feelings, but I listed them. The third feeling, the third column is, what are the triggers? What provoked this? And what provoked this anger in me was all the stuff that happened in the past. And there were more of those. What prompted this to happen? And my last one is, what character defects caused this? And the character defects are the key. And I used to say, this is not mine. I have no character defects about this. Absolutely. My character defects are so many. I want control. I want him to shut up. I want him to do this. I want him to do that. I want him to behave. So grandiosity, dishonesty. I mean, my character defects just go on and on and on. What I learned when I started doing this, these columns were so many times I was in victim. Poor me. Why can't he shape up? Why can't he go right instead of left like normal people do? You know, why all this stuff? So that's been very, very beneficial to me. And then in the fifth step, I admit that I'm admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And that's the wonder and the beauty of this fourth step process. I'll call the phone, call Ruth. She's plugged into my phone, and I'll say, Ruth, what's going on? Do you have some time? And she'll say, not right now, Faye. I'm going such and such. How about this time? You know, this afternoon, or in 15 minutes, or a lot of times she says, oh yes, in fact, most of the time. But I feel free to call her because she will tell me if, hey, I'm on my way to the potty, call you in a few minutes, or we have a doctor's appointment. So I feel real privileged to be sponsored by somebody honest who will tell me when it's not a convenient time. So anyway, I can do this thing in 5 minutes, and then I drop to my knees. And the next one, of course, is we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, because see, they're there. I know what they are. The other advantage, of course, is to talk, when I talk to God, Ruth, and Ruth, a miracle happens instantly, because when I share that pain, I cut it in half, and when I share my joy, I double it. See, sometimes it's good stuff that's in my inventory. And I also always, always, always receive unconditional love from her. And I didn't receive unconditional love many places, but from her, I have. And the other real advantage to work in this WE program is Ruth has my records. She knows all about it. I can call in midstream like I did Tuesday morning, and I didn't have to go into a 3-hour explanation about anything. I said one sentence, and she knew it all. And y'all, that is invaluable. I don't even have a doctor I can do that with, because I've had a lot of different doctors, you know. So in the sixth step, getting back to that, being entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character, all I have to do is be willing, and I ask for divine direction, and know that my mind is a garden and my thoughts are seeds. And they determine if they become flowers or weeds. So I have to be willing, and I have to be open. And then number seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. I ask God to please remove these character defects. And I have to replace those weeds with flower seeds. I have to replace it with something. And very often it's new playmates and new playgrounds. And also, I have to avoid negativity. And sometimes negativity is at my house. And I instead of moaning and groaning and being a victim, I have to learn how to stay there. Or not stay there. So the choice is mine, and I have to determine what I'll do. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. So all I have to do is have the list and be willing. And when I use that fourth step lot of, you know, I'll tack that at the at, on the other side. What could I do differently, or who do I need to, who's involved in this that I need to do something about? But all I have to do is make the list. Some time ago, this is a wonderful experience. Well, it's been more than some time ago. It's been like the last 2 or 3 years. I kept thinking about this girl that had worked with me, and her departure was not a real happy thing. And being a people pleaser, that bothered me a lot. And I said, I've got to find her. I've got to search her out. And then I would look at this list and look at this step and say, I don't know where she is. And you know, I just moan and groan about it. And one day in the airport, I ran across her. And we ran up and hugged each other, and you know, and I told her, you know, about the men's. She looked up at me. She says, "Faye, I don't remember any of that." So that goes to show how, you know, grandiose I am, thinking that, you know, this girl's hovering over all this stuff, and actually she's not. The second part of that story that is so special, at my Thursday group, my home group, one day, there she was. And she's in the program, and we've talked at depth about this and the men's. And so anyway, it's real special the way God plans this, and it's really, really good. And the other part about the men's, it's so healing. You see, when I had that 5% in that deal, I made amends for my 5%. And I never got, of course, by this time I was used to not getting any amends back. And it didn't matter. But what happened was I was healed. You see, when I made amends for that little 10-second reaction or whatever the heck it was that I had, I was healed. I was, it was the best thing in the world. And that taught me that, hey, Faye, make amends for your part. 1%, 5%, 95%. A lot of times I'm 95% wrong. So that's been good. And amends to me has been important. And I know a lot of times we feel so guilty about taking care of ourselves. When this person is in need, that person's in need. Think of me in the bed, comatose with a brother in prison in Austin, Texas, and I'm like a zombie. I mean, get a grip. I did him a lot of good, huh? Really helped him out. So when you travel, the stewardess comes out and she says, when or if we are in trouble, the oxygen will come down and affix it to your mouth, take care of you. If you're traveling with small children, do the oxygen to yourself first, and then fix the child. So I have to remember that in my recovery, to fix me, and then fix the child or the other person or whoever. So I continue to take step 10. Continue to take personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, promptly admitted it. This morning, no, it was yesterday morning, I had a real neat experience with this. Well, early on, it's with call waiting. I cannot handle call waiting. I screw up the person on the phone, the person I'm trying to get, because I don't do it right. I'll say, can you, I don't say, can you, I say, just a minute, or I say, bye. I mean, just cut them off and then get the other person. And then I just am rude to them so I can get to the first person. Well, of course, they hung up, and oh, it's just awful. And so many people know how to do it. You know, they do it politely. They level. They say, can you hold, please? Then they cut you off. And then, so anyway, so for me, my stuff is like call waiting. I mean, it's like, well, I'm going to handle it like this, and then maybe it'll work out. You know, I don't level. I don't start out leveling, and I need to learn that. I remember the first call an Al-Anon person made for me. I was on the way to the bathroom. So here I commence. Yes, I have time. And I cross my legs and I do this. And so after we talk for a couple of minutes, I can't say, oh, I'm about to wet my pants. I got to go, because by this time they're in this deep thing. So I have tried to learn to say, yes, I have time to talk to you, but let me call you back after I go to the bathroom. So, all right, so this is what happened yesterday morning. This show's coming on TV to show about its Home and Garden Network. I love it. I love it. I love it. And the thing's coming on about how to redo the picture frames, and I have 3 picture frames I've got to do something with. They all yell at each other. They all pull together. So the secret, of course, would be to reframe them all. Now, who's going to spend that money? I can't. I've blown my budget on what's on there. So that's the topic. And I thought, oh, and Kirby's going to the office. Thank you, Lord. So he's going, and I'm glued to the TV. He comes back, oh, and Faye, by the way, and do this. Oh, okay. And I do. So he comes back. And Faye, and so like 4 sentences. And it's harder to smile this time. So look. The door closes and I'm looking, and then, and Faye, and I thought, oh, and he said, I know you're aggravated. And I said, oh, what makes you think that? So anyway, he finally leaves and that segment's over. So I thought, you know, how important is it? And of course, it's his fault that I missed it, huh? So I really did a little quick 10 step on that, and I called and I said, Kirby, I need to level with you. I'm really sorry about my behavior just now. It was totally inappropriate, and I really should have leveled with you early on. Felt like I needed to watch this, and that's what I did, you know. And I really was hoping you'd hurry and leave so I could watch it when I could have told you, asked you if we could discuss this later. But I said, I failed to do that. My manipulation and dishonesty says, okay, this will be handled. He'll leave. He'll leave. He'll leave. Leave me alone. You know, that's my thing. So I need to clean up my messes as soon as possible. And I kind of did that one, but, you know, it's kind of like call waiting. I hope I can know how to do it next time, but don't count on it. The other inventory that we like to use is daily affirmations, and this has been very, very important in our marriage and in our lives. And we do 3 things, and the first, this is every evening, the first is to say what I like about him today. The second is what I like best about the day. And the third is what I'm grateful for. And then he does it to me. Now, when I first heard about it, we heard about it together, I did it myself every night for a week, and he didn't do it back. But I just wanted to do it. And guess what? The next week he started doing it back. So it's been neat. The 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all of our affair. Service, give back, give back, give back, give back. Now, we all have different talents and we do different things. One of the talents I would love to have that so many people have, this wonderful member years ago named Rena had this. That was greeting the newcomers. I mean, when they walked in the door, she was there. And after the meeting, she was there. And I'm busy running my mouth and talking to, you know, other people. And I tended to do more, you know, like I would take the office or I would lead the meeting. And she didn't do that. She would do the treasury. So we have different talents. So it's not for me to bombard somebody about taking a chairmanship or something. We have different talents, so that's what's so good, and we can do what feels right for us. And this is a program of attraction and not promotion, and As I said, we're a huge family and we all qualify, and the day Doreen came in this program was the happiest day of my life. Because I just tried to briar beat everybody and nobody took the bait, and I wonder why. And of course, Doreen didn't come in because of me. I mean, she came in where she lives because of her people or her friends and her experiences. So we'll kind of go through a little bit of the traditions as we have time. Who has number one?
Our common welfare should come first. Personal progress from the greatest number depends upon you.
Okay, and we are unified, as the first tradition says. It's a we program. And we, for me, means my partner in the recovery is my sponsor, and my family is my home group. And also, there's a third entity. I met with somebody after the 9 o'clock meeting this morning whose husband is in very bad shape. And she's in grief, I'm in grief. And I said, you know what? I said, I'm grieving for him, I'm grieving for you, and I'm grieving for your relationship. Because the third entity is very precious to me. Dear, dear friends of ours have divorced, and I grieve for the two of them. While I know the two of them are much better off individually, I do grieve for the relationship that I enjoyed. And so it's real interesting. As I told you, the triangulated family is the sick family. Today our family is direct. Kirby and I are allies. We are first, and if a child, one of our youngsters comes to us, we together decide. You know, we're not usurped any longer, or we don't do it to ourselves. Number two.
Tradition two. For our group purpose, there is but one authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern.
Okay. We got into a lot of recovery in our family when we got into family meetings, and a group conscience there. There have been some wonderful things that happened. One family meeting, we were going around the room about vacations, and Joey and Kirby had a tradition. They would go hunting at a certain time, and Leah said, well, Mom, they're going, and the family's approving that. How about you and me going and staying in the Galleria for the weekend while they're hunting? And I said, all right. I would have never thought of that. You see, so this comes out of there. Another time, she said, well, they went fishing in Mexico for his eighth grade graduation. How about you and me going on a cruise? Family voted it in. I would have never brought that up. And then there have been times when we've had log jams and where we can't get anywhere with anything. So we do a moratorium on those and come back sometimes. Sometimes they never work. Sometimes we agree to disagree as a couple or as family members. And we do this in Al-Anon as well with our group conscience. I'll talk against something. However, I, at the end of it, will always, I hope, go with whatever was decided. With the group conscience is to, you know, have a smoking meeting. I continue to go. I just have to go out and breathe a lot. But anyway, number three.
The relatives of alcoholics, when gathered together for mutual aid, they call themselves an Al-Anon family group, provided that, as a group, they have no other affiliation. The only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or a friend.
Okay, that's real important because we have met in treatment centers, we have met in all sorts of places, but it has to be real clear that we're not affiliated with them. And it has to be real clear that we pay rent to them so that we can remain independent. In our family and in our relationship, I can have my life and Kirby has his. We're not joined at the hip. Before this program, we had his life. You see, we rotated around his life. And guess what? I was a victim. Well, guess what? I can grow up and be me and don't have to, you know, he can hunt, but I can go to the Galleria, right? Number four. All right, autonomy. We vary in some things. Our groups do. The time of the day, the format, the place. Today we had different openings. It's official. A group can decide what they want to have. But the principles should remain the same. It's a come as you are program. I can go to Al-Anon in a ball gown or with my hair in rollers, and it's fine. You have loved me and greeted me every time, and it's been wonderful. In the past, I was a doormat, and that's how I was treated in my relationships. Today, I have freedom of choice, and I have to teach people how to treat me. I don't lie down and let people walk all over me anymore. It was hilarious. Early on, Joey looked at me at a picnic and he said, "Mom, what are you doing eating a drumstick?" I said, "Well, why do you ask?" He said, "You don't like drumsticks." I said, "Of course I do." He said, "Well, you never eat them at home." Guess what my piece was? The back. Because he liked the drumsticks, and somebody else liked the breasts, and somebody else liked the top leg. So that's pretty bad when I taught that to my child. So today I have a life, and I'm really thrilled about it, and you gave me that life. Number five.
Each Al-Anon family group has one purpose, to help families and alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps of AA ourselves, by encouraging and understanding our alcoholic relatives, and by welcoming and giving comfort to families and alcoholics.
So I can have serenity if the alcoholic is drinking enough. That's what we're told. And I have to be proactive. And I have to quit whining and really take action. I have to say what I mean what I say, but not say it mean. I have to be an assertive person, but not a heavy, not a Godzilla. I used to think I had to be sweet and wonderful and precious, or listen to me. I don't have to be either one. Now, can't tell you I'm totally converted because I go both places still, but I try. And I'm responsible for my own happiness. And I'm reminded of the reading in our book about the woman whose husband passed out, and she used to kind of cheer when he'd pass out, but after really looking at this tradition, it doesn't say that, but I just imagine she probably cheered. She went and covered him with a blanket. She covered him with a blanket. And to me, that kind of love is unconditional, and I pray daily that I can be Christ-like to myself and to others. And try to imagine what Christ would do. And I think Christ would put a blanket over. Okay, six.
Our Al-Anon family groups ought never endorse, finance, or lend our name to any outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary spiritual aim. Although a separate entity, We should always cooperate with Alcoholics Anonymous.
Okay, we don't own property. That means we can't be sued. And now we do own our World Service building, and that was conference approved, and I don't know if we can be sued or not. I don't think we have much of anything, so I don't think that's too much to worry about. But another part of this is KISS, to keep it simple. To keep it simple, and it says keep it simple, stupid, but I prefer saying keep it simple, simple. It's my obligation as a member, and I think it's the obligation of every one of you sitting in here to keep meetings on track. Although meetings aren't organized, if they are diverted, if we're diverted from our primary purpose, we lose, and our program deteriorates, and we need it. I need it. My children need it. Your children need it. And I have to remember that God is first. My relationship with me is second. My relationship with my husband is third. Relationship with family and friends. And then my life of work and play is all the way down on that totem pole. Seven.
Every group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions.
All right. So I have an obligation to support Al-Anon in money and in service. In doing that, my self-pity is replaced by self-esteem. When I do my part, I feel like I deserve to be here. Now, in the past, I was totally dependent upon my husband and you for my feel good. It came from outside of me. I remember one time I was in the mode of, if you loved me, you would read my mind. Okay, you would know what movie I want to go see. You'd know what restaurant. So he would say, what movie do you want to go see? I would say, it doesn't matter. And then he'd pick such and such, and I'd say, damn it. And why can't I just level? I still go back there. But anyway, I remember one morning, we were going to New Orleans to pick up somebody at the airport, and the plane wasn't until 2:30, and I thought, oh, we could go pick up Sister Thecla and take her to lunch before the airport. And then, and I'm in the bathroom putting my makeup on, and I thought, he won't want to do that. And I got furious at him. And then I thought, I had been with you, and I thought, well, you know, that's not too fair. I'm going to take a risk and talk to him about it. So I said, you know, I said, he says, sure, we could do that. And I thought, oh, fooled me. So I called Sister Thecla. Guess what? She wasn't even there. So that was that. But I did take a chance, and I am responsible for my own serenity. And I need to allow him his anger. I need to allow him whatever. And I need to learn to take care of myself in that environment or remove myself from that environment. That's mine to do. And keeping Al-Anon pure is something that I challenge each one of us to continue to do. It means taking a risk. I remember wonderful Sally. I went to her and I said, you know, Sal, I've been in here so long, and you have to. She was dying at the time. And I said, I am so tired of being the heavy and bringing the meetings back. I said, I'm not going to do it anymore. Oh, darling, she said. That is one thing I have to continue to do. I said, Sally, how would you do it? Well, darling, I would just say I'm just uncomfortable about this. And just, we have to preserve our meeting, and we need to quit. We need to bring it back to the topic. And if they don't have a topic, introduce one. So I said, okay, Sal. So I just thought she was going to take up for me and say, yeah, I don't blame you. I'm tired too. But she didn't. 8.
Al-Anon 12-step work should remain forever non-confessional, but our service centers may employ special workers.
Okay, keep the other 12-step programs out of the room. Keep treatment centers out of the room. Non-conference approved literature out of the room. The Bible's a wonderful book. Doesn't belong in the as a meeting topic. It does not belong. Professionals, keep your profession out the room. Al-Anon should be a safe haven for all of our treatment professionals, everybody. So they don't have to be on duty in the room. But most of all, their opinions aren't really what we go there for. We love their experience, strength, and hope just like everybody else's. And we learn from each other. We share only experience, strength, and hope, and we have no crosstalk. So, when we have a problem, when somebody's expounding on a problem, another way that I have heard people say is, well, let's try to decide what step this would be the tool to use in this program. And my experience is, and you know, go from there. The other thing that I think is risky is focusing on the newcomer. I've been at meetings when the entire meeting is fixing the newcomer. That person hasn't been to a meeting. They never come back. They have never experienced an Al-Anon meeting. And that saddens me a lot. I think they need to be recognized and do what Rena does, greet them before, greet them after, welcome them during. But the focus should be on having a meeting, in my opinion. That's a theism. That's not, you know, a rule, but that's me. Next tradition, 9.
Our groups as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those that serve.
Okay. I think that's a paradox because we have no bosses. It is suggested, is what all of our literature says. It never says you must do this or that or the other. But we need order. And I think one of the values is that it's a worldwide fellowship. So we need connection to the worldwide fellowship. And that comes through our conference. And that's why we send a delegate. And they make up the suggestions that they send down to us. And another thing, gang, is these conventions, these luncheons, they don't just happen, do they? And as a result of organization and somebody taking the bulls by the horn, there is order. However, the rules don't apply. Next year, they can have a different place. We had hot fish the first year. Food's gotten better and better. Congratulations, girls, and I think you'll join me in giving all the committee a hand. It's wonderful. All group members are responsible, every single one. And at home, I think all family members are responsible. One time I just got sick and tired after I'd been around you gals before. I didn't know the woman didn't have to do everything. I didn't know that. You know, I just thought the woman, the kid mowed the lawn, the woman did the cooking and the laundry and the shopping and the cooking, all of that. And then I learned that it doesn't work that way everywhere. So I wrote every job down and I said, okay, family meeting, threw them on the table. I said, well, let's read these and everybody pick the one they like. And if somebody doesn't pick them, we're going to just deal them around. So I didn't have to do it all anymore. And people, I found out my husband loves to go to the grocery store. Guess what? That has been my worst thing all of these 40 years. And now he does it. I mean, what a gift. Okay, 10. Okay, we have no opinion. How do Republicans and Democrats live together without killing each other? They agree to disagree. And that's something that they probably don't go there. When you have unconditional love, as we have in our rooms, we can have people of every religious faith or of no faith, and we get along. As I mentioned, the Bible isn't a good meeting topic book because some people are turned off by that. And I'm not turned off by it in the appropriate place. I have to really think about what's my motive when I bring up things that are controversial. 11.
Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films. We need guard with special care the anonymity of all AA members.
Okay. I talk about the AA members in my life, those who are dead and those that I have permission to speak about. I've been blessed to have been to several international conferences, and I went to an anonymity workshop, and there were people there who were big name people. The blessing is, I don't even remember which ones they were now. Isn't that interesting? But they were talking about the problem. But you know what's interesting about this issue? I want to just mention one thing. The press is usually respectful of the AA members who choose to preserve the anonymity. So that's a good one. The last one. Okay, anonymity is extremely important. To the newcomer, I think it's most important because if I use my full name in a meeting, and I don't do it when I speak, it, to me, threatens a newcomer to think that maybe they'll have to give their full name. I mean, it's just an example. While I really don't, for me and for my family, they don't. It's not a problem, the anonymity part. But for the fellowship, for me, it's a problem. There's a schoolmate of my husband's who comes to Al-Anon, and I've always, you know, I was just dying to tell Kirby about him, dying to tell him, but I couldn't. So one day we saw him at a coffee shop, and he said something about seeing us. I said, oh, thank God. I said, I've been this close to mentioning your name because I keep seeing you. The other thing that's a risk is I have to examine my motives. There was a woman who came, and she was very prominent in town and a professional person. And the profession of this woman and her husband, I think, could be tainted over program. And she didn't realize who I was. Well, big mouth here. We went to lunch together, and I start talking to her about our other life. You know, we had been in dance clubs together. We had been in this and that. That was the last time I ever saw her. And I'm not powerful enough to keep her away. Don't misunderstand me. But what was my motive to do that? You see, it's the grandiosity. It's the, whew, I could go on forever with character defects. The reason I called Ruth Tuesday morning is because I had picked up I can't even say the word. It's leaving my mind. A desire chip on Monday morning. A year ago, it was Easter. I guess I have an Easter thing. I broke my collarbone. I did have a stroke some years ago, and my balance isn't real good, and I only drank what everybody else drank, which wasn't, I don't think, a tremendous amount. But I fell that evening in my patio, and for whatever reason, I tripped, and I thought it was because of imbalance, but I don't think the wine helped, okay? So I tripped, broke my collarbone. This Easter, people came. I drank what everybody else drank. and it happened again. I didn't break anything, thank you, Lord. But I can't drink like everybody else. And for the first time in my life, I'm going to close this talk with saying that I'm Faye and I'm an alcoholic.